You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 9th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, political director for director for Credo Action, Becky Bond, will be on the program today. Also, Monica Potts, writing in the American Prospect on the Post-Ownership Society. Meanwhile, Republicans increasingly worried that their dream will come true and King v. Burwell will actually be found against the government, basically plunging the Affordable Care Act into a potential death spiral, but more importantly from their perspective, them into a potential political death spiral. Also on the program today, turns out dirty bombs aren't real. Remember that whole thing where we thought that we were going to have a dirty bomb in New York City, and so therefore we need to go attack all these countries and kill all these people? Well, it turns out dirty bombs aren't very effective at being weapons of mass destruction. And meanwhile, barely noticed, John Brennan, head of our CIA, admits the folly of U.S. intervention. Meanwhile, even more proof solitary is torture, and we do it. The cop who shot Walter Scott, you recall the video. It's always and only on video, folks. There's no abuse of unarmed African Americans when there's no video there. It only happens coincidentally when there's video, incidentally. You'll remember that video where a cop had pulled over a driver. The driver tried to run away, and the cop, in self-defense, I guess, worried that perhaps the driver, as he was running away, would kick up a pebble that might get in the cop's eye, shot him in the back. He has been indicted down in South Carolina. Also on the program today, we'll touch on Clinton's major voting rights proposal. It's left the Republicans also in a tizzy. There was a big leak of the trade and services agreement. There are three major trade deals in the work. One is the TPP, which you've heard about. The TTIP, which, of course, is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And then there is the TIS, which is the Trade and Services Agreement, which involves 51 countries. Major leak on that on WikiLeaks, from WikiLeaks last week. And meanwhile, Ben Carson, Jeb Bush's campaigns are in disarray only out disarrayed by Marco Rubio's finances until he found his billionaire. That's basically what I do. I don't even bother balancing my checkbook anymore. That's for suckers. What I do is I wait for a billionaire to show up. And then I don't have to worry about balancing my checkbook. So I just want to remind you folks, if you're a billionaire out there, you can reach us through majorityreporters@gmail.com. Or you can call in the better half of the program at 646-257-3920. Before we get to Becky Bond, and a reminder, there are a couple of days left, literally just a couple of days left, for our deal that we have with Credo. Credo Mobile is sponsoring the program this week. You've heard about Credo. I've told you about them. We're going to hear from Becky Bond. She's going to give us some more details just so that you know what Credo Mobile and Credo Action does. I got an email from a listener. Might be worth mentioning to other listeners, I chose to sign up with Credo via the phone today rather than online. Guy I spoke with was great. Very patiently answered all my questions about Sprint coverage because Credo rides on Sprint. And monthly billing charges, which included comparing my current VZ statement, I imagine that's Verizon, line by line with what Credo would charge, I'll be saving about $25 to $30 a month. I heard Credo is more expensive. Not true. And he gave me a bigger discount than the MR coupon code. Well, you make sure you use that coupon code. You waive the activation charge. Definitely worth calling than doing it yourself online. I can't speak to that, but that's the experience of this listener, but that's fine. You can go online to credomobile.com/majority report, get the deal they're offering, or you can call 800-966-1665, 800-966-1665. Use the coupon code 501-882, 501-882.
Call them and tell them Sam Cedar sent you.
Well, no, don't do that.
I'm just being
I mean,
silly,
you can do yeah, that.
I'm just being
But say, Sam Cedar told me to say 501-882.
Yes.
And they'll know what you're talking about. Also, we should just say before we go listen to Becky, we're going to speak to Monica Potts. She's got a piece in the American Prospect about the post-ownership society, which has a lot to do with you millennials that I'm looking at in this studio as we speak. Before we get to Becky Bond, I should say that we have someone new joining us in the studio every day, not permanently, unless something goes horribly awry with his. But I'd like to introduce our new intern, Noah. Do you want to say hello?
Hello.
There you go. Very well done. Noah did a great job.
Powerful.
Very questionable.
Michael has finally got someone to do the guest list. It's only been 3 or 4 years. And
three. I haven't known you for 4 years, thank God.
And now he is.
There are many other things that we're going to do. It's
actually
I
have
really
no doubt. There
it's
are many
exciting.
Other of Michael's duties that he will yeah. try and outsource to you.
Yes.
But Noah, I will tell you this, and this is the upside. You will definitely get the experience of a arguably real producer, as in because you're going to have basically all, it seems like, all of Michael's responsibilities, according to Michael.
Matter of fact, I have a training schedule at Equinox
right,
for
exactly.
now. So enjoy the show, everybody. Noah, here you are. Situate yourself.
All I can tell you is that Michael has referred to you as his sommelier. So
didn't end up going with the coffee joke. He took it in a different direction.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break. Noah is going to pour Michael a glass of Chablis to enjoy for this interview. And then we'll be right back with Becky Bond.
Strike the match and then the truth is gone.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Becky Bond, the political director of Credo Action and a VP, right? Is that right, of Credo Mobile?
Yeah, I'm the Dick Cheney of Credo Mobile, yes.
And you also sat, you chaired the committee to find the VP for Credo Mobile, is that right?
Exactly. That's how it goes here.
That's fantastic. Well done. All right. Well, Becky, we spoke a couple of weeks ago, and we meant to get to sort of talk about Credo more broadly, but we got caught up in what was happening with both the Patriot Act and with TPP, the Fast Track Authority, the TPA. The TPA seems to be still sort of winding its way through Congress, and we'll get a better sense, I think, in the next probably 5 or 6 weeks or less as to whether or not that's going to pass. But I want to start, because I know you got a couple other things going on, and I also want to do that sort of rear view mirror thing on the Patriot Act. But before we do, I want to talk a little bit about Credo Mobile, Credo Action, because your company is very unique. And I say this both in terms of like what you do, and I know this just from the sense of who we get as a sponsor. We turned down another sponsor last week or into this week. The media buyer doesn't particularly appreciate it when we do it, but we do it because we want to be aligned at least with companies who we don't have a problem with. Your company is one of the few that we don't just not have a problem with, that we actually actively want to promote. So tell us about it.
Well, yeah, we are unique, Sam, and you know, the concept that there's a social change organization out there that's one of the fiercest defenders of the environment, civil liberty, women's rights, civil rights, but also runs a mobile telephone company and a credit card company is a pretty hard thing for some folks to get their head around. And so I can understand why sometimes people don't know how to connect Credo Action and Credo Mobile, but it's true. We are an organization that fights for social change. And instead of doing a bunch of direct mail fundraising and going around to rich people and foundations and begging them to give us money, we run businesses that progressives join. So progressives will get their phone service from Credo, or progressives will get other products from Credo, and every time they pay their phone bill, a portion of that phone bill goes to paying to support progressive activism. And we spend that money in a couple of ways. First of all, part of everybody's phone bill when you get Credo Mobile goes into a pool that we divide among amazing nonprofits. We give over $2 million a year to great groups like Planned Parenthood, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, like Color of Change, Social Security Works, these great groups. And then we also spend some of that money running Credo Action, which is one of the anchors on the progressive flank that's fighting for issues in Washington, D.C. and going up against companies for causes that we all care about. And it's not just that Credo does something good with a part of your phone bill, which is like, I don't know, you know, no one likes paying their phone bill, right? But if you have a phone bill with Verizon or AT&T, like every time you pay your phone bill, you're giving money to a company that's actually giving the maximum allowed donations to guys like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, people like David Vitter in Louisiana, people that are working actively against the kinds of things that you and I believe in. So not only can you divest your money from a company that supports right-wing causes, but then you can give money to support progressive activism when you get your mobile phone from Credo instead of the bad guys.
We got asked this question, I think it was a week or two ago, for you. I mean, how much do you guys end up giving from a Credo Mobile? And how do you decide, you know, how do you decide who gets it?
Yeah, so that's great. So it's not a part of profits. It's a portion of revenue. So whether we're making money or not, money is going to causes that that we all care about. And the customers, both we take a portion off of everyone's bill and put it into a grant pool, but then also some customers overpay their bills by rounding up to the nearest dollar and there's $5, and then all that money we give away. Once a month, we pick three groups These are groups that customers nominate, and then we have a representative section of the staff select from the customer nominations. And then once three groups are picked for each month, then we turn it back to the customers and we let them vote to determine how much goes to each group. So every month it's a little bit different. It depends on how much money's coming in, but it's usually a little over $200,000. For example, earlier this year, one month we were supporting Democracy Now, Free Press, and Friends of the Earth, and Democracy Now got about $70,000, which is a huge contribution to them. Mm. Free Press, it was helping to lead the fight on net neutrality, got about $50,000, and Friends of the Earth, which is fighting really hard to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, got a lot of votes and brought down $77,000 from the pool. So every month it's a different three groups, and every month our customers get to vote on the groups that they think are the most important.
You know, it's funny. As you talk, I'm reminded of all the campaigns over the years that you guys have run, and I know that we've spoken in the past about the work that you guys were doing on Keystone XL. At one point, you had pledges from, if I remember correctly, somewhere around, was it 50,000 people?
But that was nearly 100,000 people.
Nearly 100,000 people to engage in civil disobedience and get arrested, right? Over the Keystone XL pipeline. What's the status of the Keystone XL pipeline? The last I've heard is just President Obama has yet to make a decision, but it seems like it's just sort of melted away as an issue.
Well, that's an interesting one. So we've been fighting for years to block the Keystone XL pipeline, which would tap into some of the dirtiest fossil fuels on Earth and bring it to the surface, and then a pipeline that would ship it across the United States where it could be refined on the Gulf Coast and then shipped to Asia to be burned, which would just be sort of a disastrous blow in our fight to slow climate change. And so this was something that every oil industry analyst thought was going to be a slam dunk to get approved. And so far we've stopped the U.S. government from approving it because it crosses an international border. And where it sits right now is, every day that pipeline is not approved is a victory. And where it sits right now is that the president has not yet acted on or possibly received a recommendation from his State Department on whether to approve it or not. But the statements from the White House have been quite positive about rejection. And some people have guessed that the president doesn't want to make a decision until the Canadian elections are held this fall, because he doesn't want to be seen interfering in an election by making such a big international decision that affects Canada. But we're quite optimistic that we have this pipeline blocked, and we need to make sure that the next president also doesn't approve this pipeline.
It's interesting too, insofar as that in some ways people are saying that the bottoming of prices for oil has also sort of taken away some of the fervor in terms of just how much TransCanada wants those permits. Like some suggest that they'd get the permits that they just sit on them anyways, but that's part of the game too. I mean, this is a good transition in some ways to talk about the strategy that you guys followed in terms of the Patriot Act. Because part of the game too is the longer you can draw these things out, the better, right? I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of preventing something from happening rather than actually sort of being able to, to shut something down. It can be just as an effective strategy.
Yeah, I mean, especially when we're in the minority, we know we're in the majority when it comes to the American people on most of the issues that we care about. But when it comes to Congress, because of years of gerrymandering and voter suppression and all of these techniques that the right wing has used to wrest control of some of our national governing structures, we find ourselves in the minority. And when you're in the minority, it's very hard to push something through that's positive. But what you can do oftentimes is stop the other side from making something happen, right? So it's much easier to keep the facts on the ground the same than it is to push through something that's different. And so right now the status quo is that we have no Keystone XL pipeline, and so we can continue to use a strategy to stop others from being able to make that happen. And with the Patriot Act and debate, when we were just 2 weeks ago, we were able to force a sunset of the Patriot Act for a couple days, which is a historic victory on surveillance, though short-lived. And we were able to do that because the Patriot Act, some of the Patriot Act sections, they had a sunset built into the law that it would go away if not renewed. And so what we pursued was a strategy to not let the pro-surveillance Republicans and some of the pro-surveillance Democrats, we were able to delay them from being able to pass a bill to renew that. And you know, when you're in the minority, you have to use every tool that you have. And a lot of times, what our tool is to slow down debate, to stop the bad guys from doing something to make things worse. And that can be a very effective strategy.
So the Freedom Act, which was ostensibly the reform of the Patriot Act, there was a controversy, but there was a lot of sort of disagreement or tactical or strategic differences from the civil liberties, I guess, community. I mean, those people were concerned about the spying and surveillance. I mean, just give me your take on the Freedom Act and, you know, how successful you think your Credo's work, but just but more broadly speaking, activist work were on impacting that whole, I guess, legislation and where we landed.
So Sam, it's a great question, because we actually, after the USA Freedom Act, which reauthorized some of the worst parts of the Patriot Act, was passed, at Credo we actually wrote and sent out a really long email to our members, which is something that we do periodically when we're involved in these fights. And as an organization, we do something different than a lot of other organizations, which is, instead of trying to send some short email out spinning what's going on in Washington, D.C., we like to send long emails explaining what our strategy is and what we think about what happened, especially when we get mixed results. And this is something that happened with the brief Patriot Act sunset, but then the passing of the USA Freedom Act, which then reauthorized mass suspicionless spying on Americans. And what happened there was pretty interesting. It's that there was there's the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C. that says only incremental change is possible, and that Democrats, in order to get anything through, need to strike profound compromises, often early on, and then compromise on the compromise. And then when we get something, you know, even if it's not worth the work it took to get it, or even if maybe it's even sort of worse than it was before, call it a victory, because we're too invested in having moved something forward, you know, not to have a overly sunny interpretation of what did get done. And that's something that was playing out around the Patriot Act. But something different happened, which is that there were a lot of pro-civil liberties groups and advocates on the left who really wanted to go for a win and really wanted to advocate for the thing that we really needed to see, which was actually doing away with some of these surveillance state mechanisms set up in the wake of September 11th attacks. And then, as it turned out, there was also a lot of similar advocates on the right who cared about civil liberties, who didn't like that Republicans were going along with mass surveillance any more than those of us on the left didn't like that Democrats were going along with it. And so we actually got together on a strategy to push really hard for real reform. And our thought was that even if we don't get what we want, which is in the end full repeal of the Patriot Act, but here it was expiring Section 215 of the Patriot Act, even if we don't get that, if we push really hard for it, it will be harder for the compromise solution to get even worse. And indeed, that's what's happened. Senator Rand Paul filibustered the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, and with support from the grassroots, McConnell wasn't able to maneuver around his opposition. And we found that in a situation where the Patriot Act, Section 215, actually expired for a couple of days. And as that happened, more and more pressure was put on Congress by the president, by the head of the security agencies, by the party leaders to pass USA Freedom, which McConnell and Republicans really wanted to weaken with amendments. And they threw up amendment after amendment to make the compromise bill even worse. And they weren't able to do that. And every time USA Freedom Act has come up, even though we still think it's a bad bill and a defeat, but every time it's come up, it's been amended to be much worse in the Congress. And so this was one of the first times that we saw that in order to get something passed, leadership actually had to appease the people that didn't want more mass surveillance. And so this civil liberties flank, where we actually held down a really strong position on one side of the issue helped pull Congress in our direction, helped sunset the Patriot Act even briefly, but also helped change what members of Congress think is possible. And it was really huge in people who, in Congress, staffers and members alike, who thought absolutely nothing was possible on this issue, now feel like it could be possible to pass some amendments on some of the bad surveillance state abuses as we go through the appropriations process. And we're going to see them be a lot more bold about moving this forward, because they know that, A, they can push leadership. They can make leadership blink if they go far enough. And then also they know that they have a huge number of Americans that are willing to stand behind them and say, hey, we got to get rid of some of this bad stuff that was passed in the Patriot Act.
And so, I mean, do you think that we've opened up the opportunity in the future for some type of other reform, or is it we got to wait until the next sunsetting?
No, we definitely do. I mean, there's a group of members of Congress, some on the right, some on the left, Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat, Thomas Massie, a Republican, Poe, a Republican, who are already pushing amendments which will close this secret 702 backdoor search loophole that the surveillance agencies use to spy on Americans. And also, one of the things that they're going after is the government wants to force companies to build backdoors into their technology that will allow the NSA to access private customer information. And this is something that a lot of people in Congress are uncomfortable with, and something that we're going to see defunding the ability to have the government force companies to build in those backdoors for the surveillance agencies. We're going to see that come up again and again as an amendment. It's passed the House before, and I think with the momentum from what we saw Senator Rand Paul accomplish in this fight, we're going to see it come up again, and I think we could win that this year. I think it's also important that, you know, we saw Rand Paul go to the mat for the Patriot Act, and we saw him get a lot of credit from the base of his party. We saw him do some fundraising on it, but we also saw him beat his leader. And I think that you know, some members of Congress took notice of that, and we're looking for heroes on a range of issues, but especially this one. And Rand Paul certainly proved that just one senator can make a difference if they're willing to take advantage of procedure and just willing to stand up and defy their party leadership. And we're going to be looking for more senators to do that.
All right, let's shift for a moment. Right now, you guys are working on a campaign aimed at the Democratic National Committee to allow for more debate. Would tell us about that, because I didn't realize this, but there were debates at this time last in the cycle in 2000. Well, I guess it would have been 2007. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is what's so crazy, Sam, is that in 2008, the Democratic candidates debated 26 times during the primary, 26 times, and they started in the summer. And the Democratic National Committee just came out saying that they're not going to have 26 debates during this primary. They've decided to streamline it. They're going to have 6, right? So we go from 28 debates to 6 debates. And you and I both know that informed debate is at the heart of our democracy. So we go from 26 debates in the primaries to 6 debates, not even starting till the fall at the earliest. And, okay, here, get this. Not only are they only going to have 6 debates, but they've gone even farther by announcing an exclusivity clause, which would disqualify from the DNC debates any candidate that participates in an additional unsanctioned candidate forward.
Right. So in other words, MSNBC can't say, we're going to invite all the candidates on to sit around and, you know, debate for an hour. And presumably one candidate won't show, but the ones who want more exposure do, and they get disqualified from future debates, which it seems to me they should all just agree and say, you know, what are you going to do? Have a debate with one person? But the bottom line for this, I mean, let's be honest, the bottom line is, a debate like this helps those who don't have as much money, because they get free media. And it's sort of the only time where everybody's sort of on literally an equal playing field.
Well, that's true. But also, I mean, the people that debates really help are the American voters,
right?
Because, you know, I mean, I wish everyone listened to your show, but most of the media that get, the coverage that people get from the mainstream media are these extremely scripted sound bites that focus on the horse race or personality politics or scandal. And American people actually do want to hear, you know, informed debate from the people that want to be the president of the United States. And the media won't give them that. And the debates are the only place where we actually see the candidates go up against one another and have to argue about really important things. And, you know, it's just, it's also just sort of the state of where the party is these days. The communications director of the DNC, of the Democratic National Commission Committee, was quoted on this, and I don't know if you've had Mo Elethy on your show. I think you should invite him, and so asked about this number six, right? You know, from 28 to six, he said it was. I think this was in Time Magazine. He said, "Quote: We've always said we'd like to come up with a number and stick with it." Unquote. You know, and it's just like these are the people that are going to be controlling the information voters get to decide who's going to be the Democratic, you know, candidate for president. And then he also said they asked him about the exclusivity clause, and so the communications director of the DNC about the exclusivity clause said, "Every now and then, Republicans have ideas that aren't so terrible, and this was one of them." Mm. So he's basically saying Republicans had a great idea. Let's have an exclusivity clause. Let's have the party control the debates. We won't have very many of them. We can protect the American people from actually hearing from the candidates. We think this is a great idea. Thank you to the Republicans. I mean, I know they legalized pot in D.C., you know, not too long ago, this is the message from the head communications person for the Democratic Party. We definitely need to take the middleman out.
I don't think there's enough pot in, I just don't think it's not pot. I mean, pot wouldn't lead you to, I don't know what.
Now and then Republicans have ideas that aren't so terrible, and this is one of them. That's the Democrats on the exclusivity clause so that the candidates can't debate outside of their six limited forums.
All right. Well, we have a link at majority.fm where people can go to sign that petition. And what's the hope that 50,000 people will end up, bringing this to the DNC, and it'll be at the very least embarrassing to them, or it'll get more publicity, we'll put some pressure on them? I mean, the guy's not going to go out. I would hope that the guy's not going to go out and use that line again about, well, it was a good Republican idea to limit.
Yeah, the Republicans, they have good ideas sometimes, you know, bipartisan more debates. No, the deal is we're going to get 100,000 signatures, and we're going to deliver this to the DNC. The DNC doesn't often get 100,000 of their base talking back to them. And
right.
And what's more, we're bringing attention to this on places like your show, but also in the mainstream media, who's starting to cover this, and that's going to put heat on the candidates, because clearly the DNC is going to have to listen to the candidates, and if the candidates will allow more debates, then we're going to then we can see them loosen this rule. I mean, I think that they really overshot this, you know, by not putting in a reasonable number of debates. They put in a ridiculously low number, and I think this is going to be embarrassing when their base confronts them about this, and I think this is something we can actually change if enough of us speak out and put the heat on.
I hope so. Well, Becky, thank you so much for coming on, talking about this stuff, and thank you for obviously for sponsoring the program this month. Folks, we're going to put a link up to that latest Credo Action, but noodle around Credo Action pages, because you will find that just about all the issues that are important to you are important to Credo Action, and they are actively engaged in fighting for those outcomes. Becky, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks, Sam. It's always great to talk to you and your listeners.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Monica Potts. We're going to be talking about her piece on the post-ownership society. We'll be right back after this.
Take it, make it mine.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone on her piece in the American Prospect, Monica Potts, titled Post-Ownership Society, How the Sharing Economy Allows Millennials to Cope with Downward Mobility and Also Makes Them Poorer. Welcome to the program, Monica.
Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, you outline sort of, I mean, you write this from your perspective as one of those sort of, I guess, millennials and or borderline millennials in, I guess, what we call the sort of the creative class, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's interesting. I'm interested in it because I'm sitting in front of at least two millennials. I'm not sure about the third person. If they are even like a post-millennial, I'm not sure yet, but I think they're a millennial. And it strikes me as that there is, I mean, obviously, we hear the statistics, but on a day-to-day basis, it is, it's a very strange era, I think, for people who are sort of dealing with this new economy. There are some ups, and then you talk about it sort of, the things that mitigate, I guess, the lack of opportunity also enhance the lack of opportunity.
That's right. And what I wanted to do with this piece, which, by the way, was in the Washington Monthly.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I apologize.
But, you know, there are all different kinds of, and actually if you read other pieces in this issue, it explores sort of this era of inequality and the kind of economic troubles that people are going through in many different ways. And, you know, I don't mean to say that people living in the creative class with student loans because they got graduate degrees living in these cities are, you know, the worst off among in American society. But I think if we want to think about the era of inequality that we're in a comprehensive way, then we have to sort of consider the fact that everyone almost is doing worse than people in American society who were like them did in previous generations. And so, you know, I'm a journalist. I live in Washington, D.C. I went to private schools and I got a master's degree. And I certainly didn't have to do those things and no one forced me to take out student loans. But I was making the decisions at the time that seemed best for me and that would be the most fulfilling and would also think about the way that I wanted to fit into society. And so, you know, I know people older than me, and they all make careers in journalism. They bought homes. They're cruising towards a modest but comfortable retirement. They had children. They sent them to college. They might have had to take on debt to do so at various times in their lives, but overall, they were better off because of the investments that they made in themselves, and they made a career doing what they wanted to do. And I think we have to think about whether it's harder for people to do that now and what that means for us. Do we really want a system in which people who want to move to the East Coast or West Coast cities where the creative classes have typically gathered and where a lot of the jobs are, what, you know, if it's too hard for them, if they have to take on debt to do it or if they can't afford rent there? I think we have to think about what that means for how these cities will look and how this country will look.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I got to say, you know, it's sometimes it's hard to write these pieces, I think, for people because there's a sense of other people will say, well, you're feeling bad for yourself and you've got it great. But I mean, the bottom line is that it is we're doing a disservice if we don't look at what is happening in every sort of strata of our economy or of our social fabric. And I'll tell you what struck me. I mean, because, you know, from my perspective, I was completely, I feel like, growing up, and I mean through my 20s and my 30s, and I had very little sort of, I guess, perspective on all of this because I was in the entertainment business and got very lucky very early. I didn't know anybody who was outside of the entertainment business, which sort of skewed, I think, a lot of my perspective on this stuff. I was lucky enough not to graduate with any college debt. But what, you make a great point in your piece. In just a generation, college has increased in expense by over 500%. It is stunning. And it's almost as if, like, your generation was making the same decisions that my generation did, but the landscape had changed dramatically, and there wasn't just an awareness of it. Nobody was aware of it.
That's right. And, you know, with the student loan problem, that's a really big problem. I know people are talking about it a lot in a lot of different ways, but the reality is that I can't think of very many situations in which people can go to college today without taking on any debt at all. Certainly, if I had stayed, I grew up in Arkansas, I was a good student. If I had stayed there, I would have had my tuition paid for me. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't have had other costs associated with being a college student who wasn't able to work, you know, full time and might have had to take on debt to do that or get a credit card to buy books or to be able to finance a car, which I would have had to have if I had gone to the University of Arkansas, for example. And with private schools, when you're a low or very low income student, then, you know, student loans backed by the government are part of your financial aid package. You know, they expect you to borrow the maximum amount that you can every year. So when I was looking at the grants that I got to go to Bryn Mawr, which is where I decided to go, you know, on the same page were the loans I was going to have to borrow to be able to go to school. And certainly if you're middle class or even upper middle class, unless your parents are rich enough to pay your tuition outright, there's a good chance that without a scholarship, you're going to have to borrow for the full freight of tuition of wherever you decide to go. And I think people think, well, you know, has made those decisions, their parents made the decisions, those decisions with them, they got a degree out of it, they're going to make more money down the road. I have to say the landscape is much more different and more difficult for kids who don't graduate with a degree because they're not going to get higher earnings down the road. But, you know, the costs that kids are taking on for themselves are dramatically higher than they ever were before. And so they're really taking on a debt that we haven't seen in any other generation. And just because their earning power is going to be higher down the road, that doesn't mean
do we have data yet as to how it's impacting people's decisions about where they want to work, or what they're going to pursue? Because it seems to me it could go one of two ways. One is I'm going to avoid any type of jobs, professions, careers that aren't exclusively about money or aren't more sort of directed to making money. Or the other way you go is sort of more fatalistic, like I'm always going to be in debt. I'm going to die with this with this college debt. And so why try and dig out of the hole?
I have to be honest and say I'm not very familiar with a lot of data on this, but anecdotally, I can tell you I have friends who went to law school, and when they graduated with that massive amount of debt, they went into positions at private firms so that they could pay off their debt. And these were people who wanted to go into public service law or be a public defender or, you know, work for the government in some capacity. And so, you know, I know that nobody's crying over someone with a law degree who has to take a job at a private firm that pays them more than, you know, six figures. But I think that we do have to think about whether that's the most efficient use of our talent, you know, that people are having to sort of pay their dues in a high paying, but what they consider soul sucking career for a little while before they get to do what they want to do. And I think also that we saw in the New York Times op-ed from Lee Siegel a few days ago that he decided not to pay his loans. And I know that was a controversial op-ed, but I do think people are so overwhelmed and buried with debt, they're not paying back their loans in really high numbers. I think about 7 million people default per year. They do it quietly. They do it privately. They're often embarrassed about it. The system is not particularly kind to people who default on their student loans. It's incredibly hard to get them discharged in bankruptcy to the point that it's almost impossible. And your wages and tax returns can be garnished if you default on your student loans. And, you know, we really have people paying on insane amounts of debt for 20, 30, 40 years of their lives. That's money that they're not putting elsewhere. It's money that they're not using to build their assets. It's money that they're not using to buy houses or college for their children. And so, you know, whether that's the best way for people to use their money is a question.
Let's talk about, you talk about this dynamic where there's this, you know, supposed sharing economy, where you have things like Uber, where you have things like, I don't know, what is it, the one where you get the butler, and or things like Etsy, where there are means in which to sort of almost casually dip in to these areas to make money, but nobody really makes that much money except for those who organize and basically own these entities. You don't come out and say it explicitly, it seems to me, but it's almost sort of like it's letting the air out of the tires just enough to keep things from sort of boiling over. But it's also sort of keeping people stuck in I guess this in sort of a substandard, a new normal.
I think that's right. You know, and I don't, I'm very familiar with these aspects of the sharing economy. I've used Airbnb, I've used Uber, which is a car sharing service. I've used delivery services that deliver foods and goods straight to my house. And I'm on my iPhone all the time. And I know a lot of other people who are as well. And all the people I interviewed for this story were as well. And I think that it does a few things. One is that if you have access to services, then it doesn't feel like you're not making money, right? It doesn't feel like you're poor if you can afford to take a taxi. And the point I wanted to make with these kinds of services, which are usually just apps on your phone, they have very low costs in some kinds of ways. It doesn't take you much effort to call the apps up and to get the service that you want on the other end. You just have to push a button. And also for the people on the other end of it, the people who are driving the Uber car or renting out the room on Airbnb or, people who are selling things on Etsy, their effort is also reduced. They just have to push buttons and fill things in on Grab, or if they're an Uber driver and they want to hop onto work, they just push an app and they go pick up fares where they want to and they work as long as they want. And I'm not trying to say those aren't good things, but I think that what's happened is that we can now as consumers and as providers slice up our work lives in very little bits, and so it feels like a benefit. Or, I can choose the service that I want for just an hour. You know, I can rent a Zipcar for just an hour, and so it makes it seem like it's an affordable thing that I'm doing. But what we're really doing is that these are actually very traditional services that seem new because of the apps that they use. So, Zipcar and Airbnb and Uber are companies with owners that are getting very, very, very rich off the number of users that they have. And the incentives that they have to keep their companies honest, to keep their services working properly and seeming fair to consumers, and even the pressure that they have to actually make money from what they're doing is kind of reduced because they're probably going to go public at some point soon and get a really big payday because everyone sees these kinds of apps as the future and because they have a lot of users and they collect a lot of data on their users. And so there isn't enough mechanisms, I think, to really think about whether and how these kinds of companies are actually providing a good that is useful for us in the way that we think it is.
So this is a broader criticism about the way this sort of this if this sharing economy is anything other than sort of, I guess, is ephemeral in some ways. You're suggesting that, I mean, because a lot of these are sustainable long term.
Yeah, and I think I think there's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot that they don't do that traditional companies would have done that make the people who work for them better off. And so, I think that we tend to think that these things are great and new and they're so much better than what came before, but I'm not sure that they're actually that much different than what came before. But what the people who created Uber have done, for example, is reduce their own costs, because they don't have to provide insurance for their drivers, and they don't have to provide equipment for their drivers to use, and they don't have to insure their drivers. And so all of the risk is shifted onto the individuals involved, which is a lot like what has happened with student loan debt. We live in a world not just of inequality, but a world in which, to a great extent, workers and people and consumers are very much on their own. They have all the risks, and they may receive some benefits, but I don't know that we've thought a lot about how much risk people are taking on themselves in investing in their futures and in investing in themselves as workers. And that's a serious shift in the way we've done things from the past.
So Are we just at the stage now where there needs to be sort of a greater awareness of what's happening as we make, because it does really sort of feel like, you know, what we're seeing is both slicing up the consumer experience and the labor experience so thinly that it's hard to see its impact long term, right? As in terms of labor, it's really hard to sort of to suss out exactly what I'm making. If I'm doing a certain number of hours this week and then I decide to change it next week, I'm getting paid sort of with my flexibility, which is all well and good at an age and in an era when you want flexibility. But at some point down the road, a significant percentage of people are just going to want to be able to rely on things, and suddenly to start to sort of contemplate like, oh, I'm not just working for me this week. I'm working for my kids 15 years down the road.
Or myself when I retire.
Indeed.
You know, and I think that that's right. And I think we do need to have a broader conversation, not just about the things I bring up in the article, but also sort of about what we as a society expect people to have access to, how those things are provided, and the cost to people for the services that they need to live a fulfilling life. You know, I think that if we think about what we want America to look like down the road, if we want it to be educated, if we want to be a country that is educated and that is forward thinking and is still innovative and, you know, bringing new inventions to the world and bringing new medical treatments to the world and all of the things that we think of as being part of a great country, then we have to think about whether the way that we're providing services is going, you know, educational services is going to keep, you know, engendering that kind of advancement. And so if we want the cities on the East and West Coast that are so expensive now to continue to be vibrant, creative class cities, then we have to think about whether the people who we want to live in them can afford to live in them. And these are bigger questions about the way we run our economy and the way we run our political system and the way that we expect individuals to engage with the economy, which is primarily to pay for everything for themselves. We don't like the government to pay for things. We don't like the government to tax people to provide services as a general rule. I mean, some people obviously think we should be doing more of those things. But, you know, Americans have consistently been in the past few decades hostile to those things. And so I think we have to think about whether we're actually providing the services that we as Americans expect to get and expect our children to get.
Do you think that conversation is happening really in any meaningful way?
Almost not at all. You know, I think you see all the potential 2016 and announced 2016 presidential candidates talking about inequality, but it tends to be about people falling out of the middle class and about the 1% gaining so much of the revenues from enhanced productivity. But kind of the bigger questions about the economy and what the government could possibly be doing that it is not doing, I think that as a rule, you know, politicians still see voters as hostile to the idea that maybe the government should be giving them things for free or subsidizing some things more heavily. And so I don't see conversations about fundamentally changing the nature of the economy for the most part.
The irony, to the extent that we're going to hear that, it's going to come from one of the oldest candidates, I would imagine, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders theoretically is going to be talking about that in terms of what kind of role government can play in our society. And
that's right.
And not a millennial.
Yeah, he's not. Although, you know, he's very avowedly to the left. And I think that he's the exceptional candidate in that right. regard. And whether and how he has some sort of influence or weight on the debate in either party, I think is the question. And, you know, I think a lot of people are hoping that he does. And so that remains to be seen. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, who's running for the Democratic ticket again, has already sort of started to sound more to the left than she did in 2008. And so
yes.
Maybe there's hope in that regard.
Indeed. Monica Potts writing in the Washington Monthly, folks, the Washington Monthly. And we have a link to it, of course, at majority.fm. The piece is The Post Ownership Society, which, of course, is a play on George Bush's declaring that we were living in the ownership society right before the entire economy tanked. But be that as it may, Monica Potts, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks. Boop, boop. We went a little long today in the free show. That's just because I care about you. We're going to head into to the fun half of the program, where we may or may not hear a little more from Noah. I'm already getting IMs like, want to hear more about Noah, want to hear more of the story. You know, we don't do it that way. It's got to be a little bit of a tease, right? I mean,
He has a mystique to cultivate.
That's exactly right.
He gets the biz.
He already knows. All right, the number is 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of this program, call into the show. Or you can IM me. Do you have the app? I don't know why you don't. No, do you have the app? He does. All right, so there you know. Now that's the one fact you'll know about Noah today.
Michael, do you have the app?
Of course not.
Michael does not know how to work his phone, but Noah will show him.
I know it just well enough.
We will play the clip from Fox Business Program where Josh Fox, sort of a friend of the show, he's been on many times. We haven't had him on in a while. I think last time we talked to him, he was on the Amtrak, and he had just been, like, arrested. I think I've talked to him since then. But also on Fox and Friends, apparently they're explaining to us why a 200-pound cop feels it necessary to pull a 14, 15-year-old girl down by her braids, slam her on the ground, shove her face in there, all because the guy tripped and fell like he was in an action movie and felt embarrassed.
They just don't want us to rush to judgment.
Oh, yes. Look.
They just don't want us to rush to judgment.
Sometimes there could be mitigating factors that are involved in why the cop did that.
Sometimes a video of a 200-pound cop tackling and holding face down a 14-year-old girl doesn't tell you the whole story.
That's true.
Yeah, like maybe
sometimes you got to wait until the moment after that where he pulls guns on on two other kids who, to be fair, were holding like beach towels. And I don't know if you've ever been in one of those very aggressive locker rooms where people are using their towels and whip snapping them.
That's
in a
correct.
Way that can really leave a mark. So
she was reaching for her bikini's waistband.
There you go. That's good. We have other stories too. Also, folks, a reminder, Credo Mobile, just a couple more days on that. We're going to send out an email blast, I think, on Thursday morning with this Credo deal. But I think that's going to be like the last couple of days. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. You get $100 off all phones, 25% off your data fees for 1 year. There's other deals too. Early termination fee, they take care of that for you. You can also call 800-966-1665. Use the offer code 501-882. They'll hook you up. Other than that, it is our members that keep this show afloat. You can become a member today at majority.fm. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Great way to spread word of the show. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at MajorityReportKickback.com. We really did turn down, well, I guess it's two. I had forgotten about the other one.
Turned down two advertisers
in the past couple
of
weeks.
Two, yeah, right.
They were bummed about that last one. I'm not going to say what it was.
Not it's happy just a, with that one. But that
just a company
one,
that I don't appreciate the reputation, and they're not. It's not so much. It's whatever.
It may not have been a one off. So it was a good.
They had three that they had scheduled.
Yeah, they that was a longer term thing, but we said no.
But we do rely on you guys. That way we can crap on people without any, punishment or consequence. Consequence-free crapping on people. That's what the subtitle of the show is. There we go. All right, we'll see you in the fun half.